Today is September 27th. Is that right?
Yes, right.
Right. September 27th. I do know who the president is. September 27th, 2015. And yesterday I scrapped the topic I had come up with for Taisho because I realized that the visit of the Pope is in, it's just so much in people's consciousness, my own and everyone I run into. It's such a big thing right now, and I felt that I had a chance to comment on him and his message and Catholicism as compared to Buddhism and Zen. It's always struck me that that Catholicism, that of the Buddhist traditions, Catholicism is most like Tibetan Buddhism, with its emphasis on the as a kind of a theocracy. Vatican is a sovereign state with its own head of state, the Pope, and the Dalai Lama is considered the head of state of Tibet, or always was, and still is among the Tibetans and many of us, even though it's been swallowed up by China. And there is in Tibetan Buddhism, there is an emphasis on ceremony and ritual that goes far beyond the role of ceremony and ritual in Zen, and the guru in Tibetan Buddhism, I've been told by many people in Tibetan Buddhism, is seen as if not infallible, than someone you just don't criticize. The guru or the one's teacher, they say if you criticize your teacher, the guru, then you consign yourself to hell. I feel there's so much similarity in some ways. There's so much similarity personally between the Pope and the Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama. And this is really speaks highly of the Pope. I am among those who are very impressed by him, leaving aside the doctrine that in the Catholic Church still officially has yet to deal with these sex abuse scandals decades or more, how the Catholic Church still excludes women and married men from the priesthood, the Catholic Church still rejects gay relationships and birth control, and the Catholic Church still denies communion to Catholics who have divorced and remarried without an annulment. Although this latter, there's some softening that the Pope has announced recently. So there's still major issues that most of us who are hearing this talk would have to keep us from becoming Catholics. But nonetheless, in his tone, his way of being, and in his own person, there's much to admire and respect about the Pope. I did a scan of a recent New York Times last night and learned something about his past. His name was Bergoglio, and he grew up in Argentina, Buenos Aires, and this is what was said about him in these articles, that he this archbishop, once he became the archbishop, he avoided the limelight, rarely speaking to the media, and spent little time in the affluent parts of the capital. His predecessor as archbishop had courted Argentina's political elites, but Archbishop Bergoglio erected a divide. His focus was on Argentina's poor. He created a cadre of priests who worked and lived in the slums of Buenos Aires. The article also said his papacy is a clear continuity above all on his focus on the poor. So this is someone who came to become Pope with some real street cred, literally street cred. He opened food kitchens. He and his fellow priests opened food kitchens and opened schools and clinics and drug rehab centers as the Argentine state services receded. Something very much to trust about someone who has this kind of track record on staying out of the limelight and just doing the hard work without asking for recognition. Even in Argentina, he compared the excesses of capitalism to the dung of the devil, and warned of the new colonialism of materialism, inequality, and exploitation. Now, to be sure, many columnists and others in over the years, recent years, have warned of these excesses. Maybe it says something just troubling about the Catholic Church that this is such a fresh new message that this Pope is bringing forth on behalf of the Church, and that someone of such enormous stature as the Pope that he would not just mention these things but emphasize them in his talks this past week, public talks, but also from the beginning, from the time he became the Pope, and yes, much earlier, his emphasis on these things, it seems somehow, to my view, a corrective, a wonderful corrective to how far out of balance the world has gotten. The Times quote said that he has attacked prevailing global economic orthodoxy, the belief that markets and the pursuit of wealth will lift all boats, as a false ideology, inadequate for fully addressing the needs of the poor. Another article in the Times said that the doctrine is the same, but Pope Francis has changed its emphasis, projecting a merciful, welcoming tone. I don't know how many people who are hearing this have had the chance to see him on television. There's something very reassuring and gladdening about just his own countenance, his manner, so appreciate his dropped shoulders. Recently, I said to someone in an email, they'd sent me a photo and of someone, a couple that has been married, and I said this is the mother of the bride, the new bride, and I wrote back and said, dropped shoulders, good sign. And she wrote back and said, what do you mean? And I just said that so much of our ego tension and pride comes out in the neck and the shoulders, and That when I see someone with very relaxed shoulders, just as a child has, then chances are better, and it's no guarantee, but chances are better that the person is not leading as much with his or her ego as otherwise. There's a softness, there's a... With the Pope, I even occurred to me, I had this vague memory of having read Dostoevsky's The Idiot. There's something of the Zen fool in him. Now, granted, we don't know how much of this is cultivated. One of his critics in Argentina said he's a showman. And we can know for sure how much of this is genuine and how much is not. But again, when you look at his record from decades ago, he does seem to walk the walk and has a real genuine concern for the marginalized and the poor and so forth. Especially when you compare him to the previous pope, if I may say. I jotted down some of the themes, the main themes that he has articulated in this last week in New York. Again, the whole matter of inequality, economic inequality, poverty versus wealth, the excesses of capitalism. Someone had to say that. It's become such a religion in this country, and maybe more even than other Western countries and Asian countries. It's as if there's nothing you can say negative about capitalism, because it's freedom, 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 always the freedom thing. But there are those who, as we see more and more, suffer terribly under this system. In his own words, he said, the homeless, those without medical insurance, schooling, the forgotten elderly, cast off by society, forced to live off what is discarded and suffer unjustly. That someone of his stature, his religious stature, would name this, articulate this so clearly and unabashedly, is, I think, a wonderful thing. Of course, he's labeled a Marxist and communist by some, even in Congress. I dug out this article that I haven't seen in decades, actually. Buddhism and Marxism, Compatibilities and Divergences. Unfortunately, I found it in my files about 20 minutes ago, and didn't have a chance to really glean the best parts of it. I did find one statement here. Oh, this, by the way, this article is by a Howard Parsons of the University of Bridgeport. And this paragraph really caught my eye, because it's about the Buddha, but it's so much echoes what we've been hearing from Pope Francis. Here's what it says. Gautama's description of the human condition in his day expresses a sickness unto death toward the suffering and failure of human life, the sorrow and anguish of a sensitive man who feels very keenly the human ruin wrought by unchecked aggressiveness. This aggressiveness must have been evident to him in the slaughter and destruction of imperial conquest, in the greed elicited and fed by the commodity market, in the lust for private property, in the obsession with material goods, in the crimes of the expanding cities with their extremes of rich and poor, in the ruthless pursuit of riches by those who rode roughshod over other human beings. Gautama wants to say that all these material goals are transient and illusory, that in the passage of time they will turn to ashes in the mouth, and that the feverish quest for them is a vanity, that the seemingly solid and durable body or, quote, soul, which is imagined to, quote, possess them, is itself an illusion, that the source of the suffering lies in the blind grasping of man, in the craving for sensual pleasure, the craving for continued life, the craving for power, and that the way of release from suffering and into compassion, friendliness, joy, peace, and fulfillment is to comprehend that grasping, to give up the illusion of self which springs up around it to protect it with security operations, and hence let go of all the material and mental things which possess and destroy us. The material and mental things, I would always put the emphasis on the mental things, our mental attachments. These are what gives rise to the clinging to material things and the greed that is part of that. Except if you're a monk, there's no reason to give up all material things. It's our attachment to them, or even worse, our addiction to consumerism that has to come at a cost, not only spiritually to ourselves, but to others. We also have been hearing that the Pope is warning about belief in ideas rather than belief in people, and this is good solid Zen teaching. Always in Zen, we see the danger of attachment to ideas, to doctrine, to ideology. This is one of the hallmarks of the Zen school of Buddhism. That statement about warning about the people at his public talk about getting caught in ideas was made in Cuba, so it was widely seen as a veiled criticism of communism, the communist state in Cuba, socialist, let's call it. Once also ran across an article that suggested that the Dalai Lama himself, this is a long time ago, maybe 30 years ago, would not take an outright critical stance of socialism or Marxism. I also ran across an article this morning, an old one, so old that the Dalai Lama was just starting to be seen as a world celebrity. And here's how it starts. And here, too, I think of the Pope, the current Pope. His face, with its shaved head, squarish glasses, and subtle parabolic smile, is a pop icon like Marilyn's or Michael's. Let's see where this is from. Don't know what magazine this is from. When he talks about the Dharma, his voice modulates from soughing bass to treble and back again, like someone running a finger up and down a piano. His forehead is furrowed with deep chevrons that resemble a child's drawing of seagulls, giving him an air of perpetual expectancy, concern, and surprise. That the 57-year-old Tenzin Gyatso, His Holiness, the 14th Dalai Lama of Tibet, living Buddha, embodiment of the deity of compassion, and self-described simple monk, has become a media event seems to amaze him as much as anyone. The Dalai Lama, too, we can't know how much of his really magnificent public image and presence is cultivated. After all, this is someone who went into intensive monastic training and training to claim the throne as the head of state of Tibet. He went into this training as a boy, and his whole life had been grooming him to manage these very it's a really complete training of the person and the character. I think in his case, he's always will always be a great model of Buddhist practice and training. But who knows, really, how much of that is acquired and developed. Certainly, he is a magnificent diplomat and ambassador for Buddhism, just as the Pope is. Back to the Pope's emphasis on inequality and the excesses of capitalism, and then he related to that. He talks sympathetically about migrants and those who have been marginalized. In his words, all those people who don't appear to belong. This brought to mind the fact that the Buddha, this is what the books say anyway, the Buddha rejected the caste system of his native India. This was one of the revolutionary things that he did as a spiritual leader. And last I heard, Buddhism was starting to grow again in numbers in India as a result of the untouchables, that's the lowest caste in India, of course, the untouchables becoming Buddhists, converting to Buddhism from Hinduism. So this is just to be expected of a great enlightened person like the Buddha, that he would reject such hard and fast class distinctions. It's a wonderful timing that the Pope would come and speak so with such authority about not rejecting the migrants. It's not to say that this is any kind of simple matter. I look at Europe in the last few weeks and the floods of migrants from Southwest Asia coming in, pouring into the countries there. What a dilemma. You don't want to exclude them. These are people, and many of them are in absolute extremis, terribly desperate, horribly suffering people. But how many can you take? How many can your social system absorb? This is a problem that they say is going to go on for years. I've heard it described as the first major crisis of the 21st century, this wave of migrants. Who knows how that will all turn out? And yet to categorically announce from these Republican candidates who are denouncing Mexicans and migrants as somehow other beings, are much less criminals, as a generalization, is just outrageous, of course. Here's another theme of the Pope: environmental responsibility, the recognition of climate change as a true phenomenon caused to a degree by human activity. And the broader theme of conservation rather than waste. This is also a middle-of-the-road Zen theme. There's strong emphasis in Zen practice and training on not wasting commodities of any kind, not wasting water, not wasting food, especially, above all, not wasting food. People in Zen training are told, don't take more than you can eat. You can have seconds if seconds is available, but don't take more than you can eat. Don't waste water. We try to impress on people living here when taking showers to turn off the water when you're not soaping, while soaping, rather than having gallons and gallons pour down the drain. Even washing hands, we say this at Sesshin, when you're washing your hands, why leave water gushing out of the faucet while you're just soaping your hands? It's not that hard to turn them on and off. This is not an economic thing at all. It's the last thing it is. Here we are in the Great Lakes. There's water everywhere. But to waste anything is to show contempt for it, disregard. I believe that you can only go so far in Zen practice without wincing at waste. It becomes, as we see, as we come to realize that we are not separate from things, that there's nothing out there, that it's all our own nature, our own self, ultimately, then it becomes painful to waste anything unnecessarily. I guess that's what waste means, it's unnecessary. One can get obsessive about this too, fanatical about waste, and just have it become consuming and every little thing. But things such as I just mentioned are not that hard to do. To cultivate, it's cultivating a sense of the unity and the ultimate value of water and food and other such things. what he said when he said marginalized people, the homeless, the elderly, cast off by society, forced to live off what is discarded and suffer unjustly from the consequences of abuse of the environment. These phenomena are part of today's growing culture of waste. These all come together. The disregard for people at the margins of society, the underprivileged, disregard for the environment and for and which leads to waste. So I really resonated to all this as really basic themes of Zen practice and training. And of course, peace. This is an obvious one. Probably every religion claims to call for peace, and he does. And I quote him now here: peace in our homes, our families, our schools and communities. Peace in all those places where war never seems to end. Okay, no quarrel with that. Who would have any argument with that? So how do we find that peace? Well, in Zen, in Buddhism, we would say it starts with oneself. It all arises from inner peace. Doesn't mean we can't work on the outside, work in through our institutions to find ways of cultivating more amicable relationships and peace in that way. But fundamentally, it comes down to the mind, taking care of business in our own mind, seeing into the source of conflict, of discord, and ultimately war, seeing that it really all comes down to this illusion of a separate self, which then gets expanded into a sense of us and them. Us and them, just a natural outgrowth from the belief in a separate self. So what Zen does is trace it back to the root. The root is the self, self and other. And all of the greater edifice, illusory edifices of us and them and otherness. Again, the same. It all comes down to this from these same themes: waste, inequality, marginalized, the underprivileged. Environment all comes from separation, the illusion of separation. So words are cheap. In every religion we hear these platitudes and calls for peace and justice and so forth and so forth. But what is so encouraging about Pope Francis is that he does seem, from the outside, to embody those things. He does show and speak of mercy, humility, kindness, magnanimity, and simplicity. Again, the idiot, the Zen fool. But this is not to ignore the very, very real differences between Christianity and Buddhism. First of all, there is nothing really in Christianity about shunyata, emptiness, the emptiness of all phenomena, the impermanence of hellish states. this notion of hell as a place you go to permanently is completely contrary to the Buddhist realization of impermanence. Everything's impermanent. There can be no permanent state. Everything is change. There's nothing that we hear about in Christianity about enlightenment. Here it is, the most exalted, the most wonderful experience open to a human being. And there is the method of practice. Yes, in Christianity there is prayer, and that comes pretty close to meditation. But to make it physical, to have a physical practice of postures, this is one of the great assets or distinctions of Zen Buddhism. A way to get from here to there. There is this, millions of people turning out in Philadelphia this weekend, and they expected 2 million, or there were 2 million, I can't remember. This worship of the Pope, but okay, good. Now, what are you doing about things? Take responsibility yourself. Don't just gaze adoringly at this one person. The Buddha was very strong about this too. Don't try to put me on a pedestal, he said. Work on yourself. And you see this tendency that we have as human beings to idealize someone that we see as having great spiritual stature. The Dalai Lama, I feel that he did not cultivate this kind of adoration, and yet it's very, very strong, especially in Tibetan communities and among Tibetan Buddhists. At workshops, every once in a while, someone asks me about some celebrity teacher or spiritual person like Eckhart Tolle. In the case of Eckhart Tolle, I say, well, he does appear to me to have had a genuine kensho, his genuine awakening experience. But what is he offering as a method, a way for everyone to reach the same experience? I heard that recently he's offering some little thing of that he's supposed to do, but it can't compare to the tremendous system, time-tested system of meditation developed not only in Zen but in the other Buddhist streams. In Christianity, of course, there isn't the idea of rebirth, except in a metaphorical sense. And the great emphasis in Buddhism on Buddhist philosophy and psychology, the emphasis on knowing, coming to know, what can we know, this epistemology and perception, that everything we, in Buddhism, says that everything we perceive is the projection of our own mind. This is highly sophisticated, subtle teachings, and the law of causation or karma, that we can't rely on some supreme being to save us, that we have to take responsibility for our own actions and our words and our thoughts. And the consequences of those. That's how we forge our future, not by relying on the grace of some would-be God. I ran across another from a Theravadan source, six reasons not to believe Buddhism or anything else. One, don't believe it because it's your tradition or authority say so. Two, don't believe it because it's widely talked about or popular. Three, don't believe it because it sounds logical. You know, we can't rely on logic. Four, don't believe because it appeals to you. That too can be largely a matter of transient feelings and emotions. Don't believe because it appeals to you. Don't believe because the speaker is charismatic. And don't believe because you like or love the speaker. This is the kind of down-to-earth, clear-eyed, grounded understanding of our tradition. So what? How do you believe it? So what? How can you believe it? Try it. Do it. See how it works. Stick with it. Don't just try for a few days or a few weeks, but persevere, and you'll find that it's true. But you have to do it. You have to sit, and you have to sit every day, or almost every day. You have to integrate it into your daily life. So on that note, stop and recite the four vows.